in our story, and maybe just to recap, what we intend to do this morning is spend some time and have a look at the story of Jael, right? The wife of Heber the Kenite. We're going to have a look at the rather gruesome story, I suppose, of the way in which she decides to nail Sisera to the floor. And in our considerations, we want to appreciate, I suppose, as we get into that story, of the work of our Lord Jesus Christ in how he accomplished his work in putting to death and crushing the serpent's head. So just a recap as we get into the story. We've come to a realization and an understanding, as both Barak and Deborah did, of the oppression of Jabin and Sisera, and the fact that that had come as a result of the people's faithlessness and turning to idolatry and worship. And that had come, as we saw in our first session, as a result of the parents' failure to transfer the truth and a failure of the children to personalize the truth for themselves. And as a result, there was a complete leadership vacuum that now occurred across the nation as they failed to seize their inheritance and remove the Canaanites out of their land that they had been allotted to by inheritance. And as a result, we saw 20 years of oppression that was there to turn the nation's heart back to God in seeking deliverance. And we saw into that leadership vacuum that Deborah, the mother of Israel, the nation's prophetess, comes to give sweet honey counsel to those that sought judgment. And we saw her carefully coach Barak and inspire him to a role that he was hesitantly not fulfilling. The judge that God had raised up that wasn't doing his job, and yet with careful coaching and support, she inspires him to take the lead. And in so doing, he inspires the rest of the nation to come and overthrow Sisera and their enemy and the army. And we watched as Barak and 10,000 men committed what would have been military suicide on foot, running down, charging off Mount Tabor, with swords like toothpicks to a gunfight, and wipe out Sisera and his entire army. And we witnessed as Yahweh responded to that leadership and that faithfulness as he unleashed upon Sisera and his army, as he opened the heavens and dropped and flooded the Jezreel Valley, halting Sisera's advance right in their tracks, enabling Barak and his men to take them on hip and thigh, smoke them close hand-to-hand combat until they wiped them out, chasing them all the way back to Harosheth of the Gentiles in the mud until there was not a man left, or so they thought. And so we pick up now the story in Judges chapter 4 and verse 16. And it says, "But Barak pursued after the chariots and after the host unto Harosheth of the Gentiles, and all the host of Sisera fell upon the edge of the sword, and there was not a man left." And as Barak picked through the destruction of the battlefield, he was looking for one man. One man was what he was interested in, but he was nowhere to be found. Because in the confusion of the battle, Sisera had lighted off his chariot and quietly and elusively had slipped away unnoticed as he sped away on foot. And naturally, Barak assumed that Sisera would be amongst the chariots and the host as they raced for Harosheth of the Gentiles, but he wasn't. This was a military strategist, the man who put everything in array, and he activated Plan B as he escaped out the side and running like the wind as fast as his legs could carry him. He was running in the entirely different direction to the nation. All his men were running to Harosheth of the Gentiles, but no, not Sisera. Sisera was on his way to the entirely opposite direction to Heber and Jael's tent, who lived in the plain of Zenaim. He was running to that place. Why? Why did Sisera think that that would be a good idea? Well, first reason is, well, it was the entirely opposite direction to everybody else, right? First lesson. So he was running from where everyone else would naturally assume he was going. But if we read the record carefully, verse 17 says that he was running there because there was an agreement that he had and he was running to a specific location. Look what it says in verse 17. "Howbeit, Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite." He was running to a specific location. He wasn't running to catch up with Heber. He was running to catch up into the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Why would Sisera run here? Well, interestingly enough, there is a custom in Israel with respect to the woman. So women in Israel had their own tent for their own things, something we try to avoid nowadays. Well, everything's hers anyway, right? So he's on his way to Heber's tent. We know, look at history, we don't have time to turn there, but you know, Isaac brought Rebekah to his mother's Sarah's tent, right? Genesis 24. And we know always in the story when we look at Genesis 18 and the Song of Solomon that they had their own tent. Only men that were allowed in that tent was the father or the husband of that woman. And therefore, if you were searching for a man, you certainly wouldn't go looking for them in a woman's tent. That was totally off the record, out of bounds. But what we also know, is what it says in verse 17, is it says there was more than just the fact that there was a tent that he could go to that people wouldn't look for him. There was a peace accord between Jabin, king of Canaan, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And we're now introduced in the story to two people who are integral to the story. Heber the Kenite and Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Isn't it an interesting expression? Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. It's the title that gets given of her all the time. Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. And you think, wow, there's something important about this man, Heber the Kenite. We're given his origin, we're given his name. Why? The record's at pains to remind us who he was and where he came from, and the title that gets given him to distinguish him from every other Heber that might exist. He's called Heber the Kenite. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, well, what do we know about Heber the Kenite? The answer to that, brothers and sisters, is actually quite a lot. So Heber, his name means a community. Comes from the root word meaning a house in common, the idea of fellowship. So the Kenites were a community of people who had fellowship in their environment with themselves. And what we notice about this man, when we go back to Judges chapter 4 verse 11, is that this man had severed himself from the Kenites, verse 11 of Judges 4. And he'd gone instead, picking up his tent and relocating it up into the north, into the plain or the oaks of Zenaim. This man had separated himself from his family, from his own community, from those he had fellowship with, from the rest of the Kenite families, to seek fellowship with another community. Was that a bad move? Should he have done it? What do we know? Why had Heber moved, brothers and sisters? Well, firstly, perhaps it's helpful if we spend some time to look at the history and the origins of the Kenites. And this is a study in its own right. But we want to spend 5 minutes to summarize the family of the Kenites because we actually know quite a bit about the Kenites. So who were the Kenites? Well, first of all, we know that Hobab, who was the son of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, in Numbers chapter 10, verse 29, had a lot to do with Moses. Hobab was the father of the Kenites. Jethro was the leader of the family, but Hobab was his son. But what we know is that Moses had originally sought refuge in Jethro's house in Exodus chapter 2 when he fled Egypt and he ran into Midian. And there, we know he tended for Jethro's flocks in Horeb for 40 years. And Moses then marries one of Jethro's daughters in Exodus chapter 2. And Moses leaves Zipporah and his two sons in Jethro's care when he goes back to Egypt and then meets up with the family when they go back to Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 18. And so what we know about the Kenites is that they're a nomadic family that lived in Midian in the desert. And what we know about Jethro was that Jethro embraced the hope of Israel. He rejoiced in their deliverance from Egypt and offered burnt offerings and sacrifices with the nation of Israel in Exodus chapter 18 and verses 9 to 12. And actually, Jethro offers enormous amount of support to Moses in the wilderness to help him with the administration of the nation to try and alleviate Moses' pressure of all the workload that he had to do. Because he watched Moses as he tried to manage the nation's affairs and their needs in Exodus chapter 18 and gives sound advice to Moses. But Moses turned to Hobab, Jethro's son, who was journeying with them from Mount Sinai, and says to him, well, come with me now to Numbers chapter 10. I want to show you what happens in the story to the Kenites. Numbers chapter 10, here's Moses having a conversation with Hobab. Numbers chapter 10 and verse 29. So here they go, verse 28, they went on their journeyings. Numbers 10, verse 28. The journeyings of the children of Israel according to the armies when they set forward. So they're on their way as in the wilderness. And Moses turns to Hobab, the son of Raguel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. So this is Jethro, but this is his son, Hobab. And he says to Hobab, look, we are journeying unto the place of which Yahweh said, I will give it you. So we want you to come. Come there with us, and we will do thee good. Come out of the land of the wilderness of Midian, and come and join us, he says. And we will do thee good, for Yahweh hath spoken good concerning Israel. And Hobab on that occasion said to him in verse 30, I will not go, but I will depart to mine own land and to my kindred. And Moses pleads with him, leave us not, I pray thee, for as much as thou knowest how we are to encamp in the wilderness, and thou mayest be to us instead of eyes. You can be watchmen for us, to look out for us. And it shall be, if you go with us, yea, it shall be, that what goodness Yahweh shall do unto us, the same will we do unto thee. Moses pleads for them to be the eyes for them. Tuck that away, by the way. He wanted them to be the eyes for the nation of Israel, to be watchful, to help them. We're going to find that those eyes sell Barak and his men out. And so what we find about the Kenites, they were nomads in the desert. They knew the desert like the back of their hands. And we know from Numbers 10 is that Hobab initially refuses to go with the nation of Israel. However, what we do know, brothers and sisters, is that subsequently he reconsiders. Because we find the Kenites in Judges chapter 1. Come with me now to Judges chapter 1. Here they come. Because Hobab must have reconsidered. He was torn. He wanted to be with his family in his own land. However, we find in Judges chapter 1, they must have changed their view. Because in Judges chapter 1, in the story of the subjugation of the inheritance of Judah, it says in verse 16 of Judges chapter 1, it says, and the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth to the south of Arad. And they went and dwelt among the people. You see, initially Hobab must have refused, but subsequently the family reconsiders and the Kenites come on the journeyings with the children of Israel and receive an inheritance allotment amongst the tribe of Judah whilst they still maintain their independence as their own community in a wilderness. And so they relocate into the wilderness in the south of Arad. But it says they fellowshipped, it says, with the children of Judah. And so what we can summarize out of the story is that they were a God-fearing people. They wanted to be there. They wanted to have close ties now with the nation of Israel to receive the ongoing blessings of the fellowship that was promised to them in the land of promise. And we know that they were to be the eyes, the watchmen for the nation of Israel. Do you know what's remarkable, brothers and sisters, when you trace this family through history, they were an incredible, faithful family. And we know the following things about this family of the Kenites. And 260 years after their establishment in the area of Judah, and during the time of Barak, after that, in the time of Saul, 1 Samuel chapter 15 says that the Kenites were faithful to Israel. And they were spared destruction because of the tight relationship that they had with the nation of Israel during the time of Saul. And 290 years later, in the time of David, in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, this family became known as the Rechabites, those that were known for being the scribes amongst the nation, the faithful Bible students that maintained an understanding of the law of Moses. And 450 years after this point, brothers and sisters, in the time of Jehu in 2 Kings chapter 10 and verse 15, the Rechabites were known for the keeping of the law and particularly for standing against apostasy and maintaining a pilgrim status amongst the nations that were there. And 740 years later, this faithful family, in the time of Jehoiakim in Jeremiah chapter 35, are still there, remaining separate from apostate Judah, who was gone astray, and the Rechabites were still following the law, maintaining a steadfastness for the truth, showing the nation themselves far more faithful than the tribe they first had fellowship with. This was a remarkable family, brothers and sisters, that stood the test of time, who learnt the blessing of transferring the truth from generation to generation. That's the story of the Rechabites. That's the story of the Kenites. Now, brothers and sisters, come back to the story of Judges chapter 4. Now let's think about the decision that Heber makes to sever himself from that community. See, Heber, and it's a great translation, by the way, had severed himself from this faithful family. This man had cut his ties from the rest of the Kenites living in the Negev desert in the south. And where had he gone? The answer is he had gone to reestablish himself and his family in the northern parts of Israel in the oaks of Zenaim. Zenaim was on the border of the inheritance of Naphtali, about 4 kilometers south of Kadesh Naphtali, and about 12 k's from Mount Tabor. They had totally left the Negev and were living in the north. Now the question we have to ask ourselves is why? Why had this man moved? Why had he changed his alliances and his allegiances? Was it for better climate? Was nicer weather? Or was it a better environment for him? Or did he have a falling out with his family? Well, we're not told, brothers and sisters, except for this. One can't miss the Bible echo, can you? With another man that moved for another reason and for economic decisions. You see, I believe, brothers and sisters, we are given this very pattern to try and help us understand why he severed himself. It's exactly the same word in the Hebrew of Genesis chapter 13 and verse 11, where Lot severs himself from the faithful family of Abraham. And both of these men go and re-pitch their tents toward a plain, and both make peace with the new surrounding families. Lot had separated himself from Abraham, we know, for an ease of lifestyle. It was just like the water of Egypt. You could kick it with your foot and the water would come. It was amazing, green everywhere, the fertile pastures. It was remarkable. He moved for economic prosperity to the rich soils of the plain of Sodom. That's why Lot moved. It was an economic decision for Lot, a better lifestyle. And it was no different, brothers and sisters, I believe, for Heber. Do you know why, brothers and sisters, I suggest that? I suggest Heber moved for employment. And here's the proof. Do you know what the word Kenite means in the Hebrew? It's the word for smith. The word for a metal worker. The word that's used to describe an artificer of metal. Now, what we know, therefore, is that the Kenites were a group of nomadic metal workers. Now, here's the question. Where do you think the employment opportunities were in Israel at this current point in time for metal workers? Well, what we know, brothers and sisters, is Judges 5 verse 8 says that they chose new gods, there was war in the gates. Was there a shield or a spear seen amongst the 40,000 in Israel? There was not much work needed for fitted and turners amongst the nation of Israel at this current point in time, was there? No, where the employment lay was with the guy that owned 900 chariots of iron. I believe he had relocated up north for a more prosperous life, more money, better career prospects, and note, brothers and sisters, no fear of attack. Why? Because verse 17 says, for some reason, there was a peace accord between Jabin, who was the king of the entire Canaanites, and the family of Heber the Kenite. Now, here's the question. On what basis did little old Heber the Kenite have a peace agreement with Jabin, the mighty king of Canaan, who had subdued most of all the northern tribes of Israel and was on a first-name basis along with his wife, with Sisera, the captain of the army? You see, Heber's household had a protection policy, an insurance policy of peace. Now, Heber didn't have any more power. He didn't have a huge army. He didn't have any more money. But he had skills. He was a metal worker, a mechanical skills. And by the way, brothers and sisters, that might explain why Jael was so easy to get her hands on a workman's hammer. You see, this peace agreement was made on the basis of trade, a mutual economic benefit. Quite possibly, Heber was the chief mechanic of Sisera's army based in Harosheth. Harosheth, the city of mechanics. You see, so here, this Kenite, who ought to have been the eyes, Israel's eyes, to protect them, had severed himself, brothers and sisters, from his brethren and switched allegiances. Verse 12 says, they showed to Sisera that Barak, had the son of Abinoam, had gone up into Mount Tabor. They sold them out. He had been watching Barak, and he'd called for assistance, witnessed him amassing his supporters as he ascended Mount Tabor. Instead of watching out for Israel, he sold them out. See, Heber had relocated for better economic lifestyle. He'd made his decision on the basis of better career prospects and employment. And in so doing, he'd relocated his wife and his entire family and severed himself from the fellowship of the faithful Kenites. Brothers and sisters, there's a fantastic lesson for us in this, isn't there? You see, leaders should factor in all the costs. You see, employment is needed, we know, brothers and sisters, to eat. We have to maintain ourselves in this life. It's important to do our best in whatever we do. Remember, 1 Timothy chapter 6 tells us very clearly that the pursuit or the love of money is the root of all evil. Everything in life comes at a cost, doesn't it? There are always opportunity costs, the next best alternative. And we have trade-offs. And that benefit is a challenge if it's going to destroy our family. You know, if we change jobs, we have to ask the question, what is it going to cost me? If I take that promotion, how much more travel might there be? With respect for employment, generally, in my experience, more money comes with more responsibility, which usually means more stress and less time. That's why Timothy says, godliness with contentment is great gain. Contentment is the key. We've got to be so careful about our economic pursuits because it's so easy to lose sight of what we're actually here for and be caught up with, why, the cares of this life. We've got to factor in the opportunity costs in every decision that we make. And for Lot, well, he lost everything He lost his family, he lost his wife, he lost his happiness, he lost everything. He went from a better economic lifestyle and prosperity, he ended up as a hermit in a cave. He didn't factor in the opportunity cost, and neither did he, brothers and sisters, because jail wasn't too happy about this decision. Back in the story, we know that because it says, verse 17, Sisera had dropped off his distinctive chariot and in the confusion was running for his life in the opposite direction as fast as he could. His ultimate destination, no doubt, was most likely Hazor, Mummy's place, to find shelter and protection. Sisera's mother lived up in the castle in Hazor. He was sitting here in jail's tent until the challenge of the battle blew over, till the heat dissipated, that he might find shelter and protection and then sneak up to Hazor. And so heading for familiar ground with people he thought were allies, he strikes out for Heber's campsite, but particularly jail's tent. But if Sisera was seeking sympathy and safety, he put the wrong woman in the wrong tent on the wrong day. There's nothing soft about this lady. So he runs to Jael's tent. Who was Jael? Well, this woman had lived her life growing up as a nomad in the desert in tents. The Kenites were a hardy people. Her name means a mountain goat. These people lived in goatskin tents. She's going to serve Sisera goat's milk from a goatskin bottle and cover him with a goatskin blanket. She was the ultimate goat. And for Israel, she was the greatest of all time on this day. You see, for everything she was rugged and rough. She was used to the harsh elements and the living conditions of the blowing sands in the desert, the shifting of the wind. Her nomadic existence was all about enduring hardships and isolation. You know what's remarkable is that Heber and Jael stand together as antithesis of each other and what they stood for. If Heber lived on the plain, she was a mountain goat. If Heber wanted to make peace with the enemy, she was used to fighting for an existence. Heber was seeking for economic prosperity, she was used to hardships. And whilst he wanted a fellowship and coffees in the villages, she wanted isolation in the desert. One was a city slicker and the other was a nomad, brothers and sisters. What a family. And whereas Heber had made decisions for a better lifestyle, for more money and improved living, Jael wanted the opposite. She wanted her nomadic existence. She wanted to be in isolation without the complications of what this new life had brought. And whilst Heber had severed himself, brothers and sisters, from his brethren in pursuit of a better way of life, Jael obviously had not agreed. However, in submission, she'd gone. And whilst utterly repulsed by the treacherous peace accord, she obeyed and bided her time, trying to encourage her husband by her way of life, as Peter calls it, to help her husband to return. And the time came for that opportunity. In verse 18 it says, as Sisera sped past them, Jael went out to meet Sisera. In the Hebrew it means to go out with intent. This was a deliberate action. Brothers and sisters, she recognized Sisera from a distance and worried that he might run straight past. She decides to interact with him before any of the servants did. And so she comes out and she says to him, turn in, my lord, turn in to me, fear not. Turn in, my lord, Adon, my ruler, she says. Term of respect. Come in here quick, quick, come in, close the door. And carefully and deliberately, she encourages him to find sanctuary in her tent. This was her opportunity. You can just picture the scene, can't you? I mean, it's probably not too good to picture, but anyway, think about it. Sisera's just run his skin off, right? Blood stained, covered in mud, fatigued, sweaty, scared stiff. Probably the first time he's ever experienced a defeat like this, ever in his life. He's petrified. And here was a woman he knew whose allegiance he thought were clearly aligned with his. This was the family that had given him the tip-off in the first place. We'll find safety here. And here she was offering him shelter and safety in her tent. Why not? I'll lie low until the heat blows over. I'll recover strength and then I'll shoot for Hazel. And so he turns aside, and as he does so, she covers him with a mantle, a blanket. You see, she covers him. Only ever really floods in the Jezreel Valley in winter, so we can probably assume it's probably cold. He's probably shivering uncontrollably for the shock as the adrenaline's going to leave his system. And she covers him, not just to warm him, but to conceal him. And a mantle is a thick blanket. Any guesses what that might have been made of in this tent, brothers and sisters? Most blankets for these people were goat skin and coarse goat's hair. And as he lay down, Sisera realized that he was absolutely parched. And he turns round to her, and look at the language of respect. This is the rule. This is the Sisera who ran the entire army for Jabin, king of Canaan. And look at the words he uses to her. Oh, he says, give me, I pray thee, a little water. It's the language of respect. He thought he'd totally found safety here. Can I please have a drink of water? She says, no, I can't give you water, but I can certainly give you cream. Not anything but the best for you. Water? Surely not. How about something a little bit more substantial? Now, guess what type of milk nomadic tribes drink, brothers and sisters? And it's not cow. It's goat's milk. And she opens a new bottle. She gives him a new bottle of milk. It's made of goat skin, as the Gibeonites did in Joshua chapter 9. Milk specifically for the occasion. She gives him to drink, and then she covers him again. Only the best for my Lord. Sister's in Jael's territory and in her control. He was totally out of his depth, and he had no idea. I'm given more detail of what he gives her in chapter 5 and verse 25. Have a look over the page. Deborah's song. He asked, verse 25 of Judges 5, he asked water, and she gave him milk. She brought forth butter in a lordy dish. Butter is the word for curdled milk. It was like yogurt. This wasn't just plain old milk. It was the best she could give for her lord. In a lordy dish, the dish of mighty nobles is what it means. A lordy dish. She pulled out the best china for this particular man. She wanted Sisera to feel that he was an honored guest, a respected man of honor in her house, and that he was in good hands and good company. And in so doing, she lulls him into a false sense of security. But everywhere he, Sisera, has one more request. Look what she says, verse 20, come back over the page. Judges 4, verse 20. Stand, he says, in the door of the tent, and if any man doth come and inquire of thee and say, is there any man here? Say no. So Sisera, now having his fears removed, his adrenaline subsiding, the milk quickly working as a natural sedative on his heavily fatigued body, falls fast asleep in utter exhaustion. And Jael steps forward to seize her moment. She sees the opportunity to strike. And brothers and sisters, read carefully what it says in verse 21. And you can't miss the import of the record, can you? Then Jael, Heber's wife. Why are we given the extra detail again? We already know she's Heber's wife. No, this decision and this action had something about his decision that he'd made. Oh, she wasn't happy with his decision. She's known as Heber's wife. And she goes and takes, notice, a hammer in her hand and a tent peg. Why, brothers and sisters? Why does she use a tent peg and a hammer? Well, just look at why she does it. This was a crime, brothers and sisters, of passion. This was a brutal murder, a premeditated murder on her part. She knew what she was going to use to destroy this man. She'd planned this moment in her head, had no idea when it was coming, and she saw the opportunity. She takes a tent peg and a workman's hammer, the two things that represented her nomadic existence and the tool of her husband's employment. the two things of her frustration, brothers and sisters. This was poetic retribution. The tent peg, a symbol of her Kenite nomadic existence. You grab a colouring in pencil and you colour in how many times it says the word tent through chapter 4. They had pitched his tent, says verse 11, in the plain of Zenaim. Howbeit she fled on his feet, verse 17, to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. She turned into the tent. He turned into the tent, verse 18. Stand in the door of the tent, verse 20. She took a nail of the tent, says verse 21. You colour that in. You can't miss it. Chapter 5, verse 24 as well. Right? Blessed art thou of all women in the tent, says Deborah. Judges 5, verse 24. So she picked the tent peg because it represented her nomadic existence, where she lived, and the frustration of relocation. And she took the workman's hammer, a symbol of her husband's employment. That's the word that gets used. Chapter 5, verse 26. A workman's hammer, it says in verse 26. This wasn't to bash in tent pegs. This was a metal working hammer, a hammer used for foundry work with metal. This is Heber's tools. You see, Jael chose to use these tools and implements to exact her fury and her revenge and her frustration on Sisera in retribution for the pain, the torment, and everything that this system had brought upon her and her family, for Heber's severance from her Kenite family and her relocation away from the ones that she loved and had fellowship with in the hope of Israel. It had taken a huge toll on her. And she picks those two things to exact her premeditated revenge. And note what she does. Verse 21 says that she tiptoes into the bedroom. And bam! She smote the nail into his temples and fastened it into the ground. You know, when we reconcile Judges 5, what we see in the story is what actually happens was so fast and full of fury and an activity like you wouldn't believe, right? And it was a frenzied moment, because what actually happened was she didn't just come out and balance the tent peg. This is not just a normal little tent peg that we have. This was a huge, whopping, great big wooden tent peg. So what happens in the story in Judges chapter 5 when we reconcile it is that firstly, it says, so verse 26, she put her hand to the nail and her right hand to the workman's hammer. This is Judges 5, verse 26. And with the hammer she smote Sisera, she smote his head when she had pierced and stricken through his temples. At her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay down. At her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell down dead. And in the Hebrew, brothers and sisters, this is how it describes it. She first hit him over the head with a hammer. And she hit him over the hammer with the purpose of to smite in pieces, to smite through. And then she smote him again to dash him in pieces and to pierce him and bore him through. That's really what it means in the Hebrew. To smite with a hammer, to smite in pieces, to smite or to dash in pieces, and to pierce and to bore through. So I think what we can reconcile in the story is that she first hit him over the head with a hammer, and as she did so, he reared up. And in panic moments, she hit him again and again, knocking him down. Then she grabbed the tent peg, balanced it on his head, and drove it through his temples, repeatedly hitting him in a frenzied attack until she was absolutely 100% convinced that he was gone, because while his head was crushed, only then did she stop hitting him. This was a frenzied attack, and there, lying at her feet, lay the man who she hated, Sisera, in his own blood, pinned to the floor. This was retribution of poetic form. Jael reenacted out, brothers and sisters. Think about this. Jael reenacted out what the deceitful agreement and a better lifestyle had done to her. You see, she felt pinned. She felt trapped. She felt crushed. She reenacts out what that peace accord had done to her and her family. You see, whilst Jabin and Sisera's peace accord and employment proposition had offered Heber the freedom and the opportunity to do what he wanted, to achieve what he needed, It had fastened and caused Jael to be pinned in a place she never wanted to be in the first place. And in her actions, she fulfills the prophecy of Deborah, doesn't she? Yahweh says, chapter 4 and verse 9, Deborah says, Yahweh will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And it says in Judges chapter 4 and verse 21, she takes the hammer in her hand and destroys him. And she thrusts him through the temples. Why are we given the detail of that? Why the temples? Why the detail? Well, firstly, and excuse probably the grossness of this, but it was the easiest place to penetrate. It's the flattest part of the head. It's right in the middle when you're sleeping on the side. It's the softest and thinnest part of the head. There's no bone to contend with. And so she firstly used the easiest place to drive it through. But the temples have a biblical significance. It's only used twice outside of this scenario in the Song of Solomon, chapter 4 and verse 3 and chapter 6 and verse 7. The only two other times. And it's on both of those occasions, it's likened to a piece of pomegranate. It's red on the outside and white inside. You can understand why the likeness works. But inside a pomegranate, brothers and sisters, is a thing full of seeds. It's just like the brain. It's red on the outside, white on the inside, and full of seeds. And Jael attempted not only to destroy Sisera, but she wanted to destroy the thinking of Sisera. She wanted to destroy the seed of Sisera's serpent. She wanted to destroy everything about Sisera, his actions, his motives, his mentality, that it might no longer capture or might no longer dominate anyone else ever again. And she punched a teed peg through both temples that his brain might never escape. And she killed him in two stages, knocked him out first with a hammer and pegged him into the ground. Very similar when we go through the story of Daniel chapter 2, the smiting of the image in the feet and the crushing of it to powder, the story of David when he knocks him out with a stone and the cutting off of his head. If we're ever going to overcome the enemy in ourselves, it requires us to be totally and utterly committed to destroying. Often it requires two stages to actually get it done. And she smote him on the head and then crushed his skull. Meanwhile, brothers and sisters, on the battlefield, Barak realizes that Sisera has escaped. And finding evidence of Sisera's subtle retreat, he sets off on foot. Verse 22, you have to picture the scene. And the record gives us a little bit of, you know, whenever you see key words like this, verse 22, and behold as Barak pursues, right? Whenever you see that, it's the Bible shouting at us. Behold, he says, as Barak pursues, out comes the corner of the tent, flat door comes in. Oh boy, you want to see this sight. You see, here comes a woman who goes out to meet now Barak. And as Jael steps away from Sisera's lifeless body, and probably headless also, she hears Barak's noisy pursuit as she had with Sisera and goes out to meet him. You can link those. Jael went out to meet Sisera, Jael now goes out to meet Barak. And picture the scene. Barak comes around the corner and emerging from the tent stood a woman, the hammer probably still dangling from her hand, covered head to toe with blood and brain tissue, her hair wild, her eyes bloodshot, but humble in her victory. And look what she says. Come, and I will show thee the man whom you seek. First, there'd have been the shock for Barak, seeing Jael in this state. The second shot was seeing Sisera and the murder scene, brothers and sisters. Sisera lay down dead. As he goes into the tent, he sees the nail bang through his head. There was no doubt what had happened in that tent. There was no doubt who'd killed him. And Deborah's words would have rung straight through his mind as he witnessed the scene from verse 9, that Yahweh shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman, exactly as Deborah had prophesied. And thus God subdued on that day Jabin, king of Canaan, before all the children of Israel. Barak knew that it was God who had fought for him, God who had delivered the entire host, and God who had worked with Jael to slay Sisera. And it all fell into place for Barak. Up, this is the day that Yahweh hath described. Is not Yahweh gone out before thee? And this galvanized Barak now to lead the entire rest of the army and all those that he could muster to take on the rest of Jabin and all of his host to take back the territory that they once had lost. Brothers and sisters, that gruesome story is absolutely captured for us in the battle that our Lord accomplished for each and every one of us. See, because in the story, brothers and sisters, in the crushing of this seed of the serpent, we can't but help to see the type of our Lord Jesus Christ in the accomplishment of the destruction of sin. Come with me to Hebrews chapter 2. You see, our Lord took on in himself this thinking of the serpent and crushed him. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14 says, "For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, which is the diabolos." And note what it says now. "And deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject now to bondage. For verily he took not himself the nature of angels, but took on him the seed of Abraham. Wherefore in all things it behoved him to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself hath suffered being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted." And you see, in Jael's time, brothers and sisters, she delivers the nation of Israel from the one that had captivated them, that had oppressed them. And our Lord Jesus Christ, in his putting to death of the flesh, delivered all of those who through fear of death have been all their lifetime subject to bondage. And so, brothers and sisters, as we consider his sacrifice and we consider what he achieved for each and every one of us, let us not see the clinical aspects of Christ's sacrifice, but the murder scene that took place that we might have life and have it more abundantly.